It's time for Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks for joining us today. We're taking a look at how to attract hummingbirds to your garden by planting some of their favorite things. And who better to ask than Melinda Myers? She is a nationally known gardening expert, TV and radio host, author, and columnist with over 30 years of horticulture experience. What plants do hummingbirds like in your garden? Do you have questions about what plants will work for you? Or any other gardening questions, of course. Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can always send an email, and that's talk@wpr.org. Melinda, always great to chat with you.
Always good to chat with you and your listeners as well. And we have a beautiful day after some rocky weather in much of the state. So it's kind of nice to think about beautiful flowers.
That's right. I was just shocked at how gorgeous it was this morning after what we went through yesterday.
Exactly.
Wow. Yeah. And we didn't get much rain in Watertown where I live. We were kind of in between all of that. So my lilacs are still in perfect shape. They've been around for so long. This year, I'm really enjoying them.
Isn't it great? My crab apple went in and out of bloom pretty quick because of the heat, came just as it was in flower. But I have to tell you, I moved all my pots I've been hardening off the back patio in the house because we had 38 mile an hour wind, and I think it would have been in the farm field. So it was worth the extra effort.
For sure. Well, hopefully we're a little bit safer now to put those out. We want to talk about getting those hummingbirds to your yards. I mean, especially when they come for flowers, because I always felt very proud on my last garden that the hummingbirds came without having to put a feeder out, which is great for me because I always forgot to put the water in. But, you know, what kind of flowers are hummingbirds actually looking for?
You know, and nature is the best feeder, right? The flowers, you don't have to clean it. You don't have to restock it. And it's important if you put feeders out to keep them clean, to keep the hummingbirds safe. So a couple of things. Some of my favorite annuals that are also favorites of hummingbirds, Anna salvia. All the salvias are great, but Anna salvia, Salvia gargantea, is this really big one. Unfortunately, not hardy here over winter, but it's a big plant, blooms nonstop all summer. Things like black and blue, purple and blue, Roman red, those are great. In fact, mine are still in their pots waiting for their permanent spot, and the hummingbirds were nectaring on them sitting on the patio.
Wow.
I know. So it's fun to see. Kufias, you may know them as cigar plants or bat plants or tiny mice. Kufias are wonderful. They're one of the magnets. I always tell people, put a pot on your, you know, railing by your deck or a pot outside your window, and you're sure to see hummingbirds come and nectar on those. And so they bloom nonstop. You may know the Vermillionaire. It's one I put in a container, very drought tolerant. I don't do any deadheading.
So oh, nice.
Key for me. And it keeps blooming and keeps the hummingbirds very excited. We grow milkweed for monarch caterpillars, but hummingbirds nectar on the flowers as well. So you'll see bees and hummingbirds and butterflies on the blooms, and you're helping support the monarchs. You know, butterfly weed, the orange flowering one, and swamp milkweed are a lot less aggressive. So if you've got a small lot or, you know, you don't have time to manage the common milkweed that can be a little overpowering.
Yes.
Yes, you must be fine. I know I'm fighting. You know, I'm trying to corral them.
Yes, exactly. They pop up where you don't want them.
I know. And I keep going, you can grow over there. And they're not listening.
No.
Some spring blooming perennials, columbine, a favorite. Those little spurs are full of nectar, and you'll see hummingbirds on those. A lungwort. Dawn, who works with me, always says she watches her lungwort for the flowers and also the hummingbird. She goes, that's usually the sign they've made it here, and they'll nectar on those blooms as well. Nicotiana, flowering tobacco. Fuchsias, an impatience for people with the shade. I had one gardener tell me she had impatience planted along the walk, and she saw a hummingbird standing there just nectaring on the flower.
Oh, my gosh.
Off of the sidewalk. I know. A little comfortable.
Uh-huh.
And begonias, of course.
Mm-hmm. What about into the fall? Besides the annuals, are some things that we should be thinking about for their trip back to wherever they went or going,
You know,
say?
That's That's great because they will go after some of those fall bloomers. So I grow our native honeysuckle vine that blooms all summer long and into the fall. I like Major Wheeler that's more disease resistant. And one of the nice things is the hummingbirds also eat insects. And so if you have a few aphids on your native honeysuckle vine, they'll help manage those aphid pests. So it's an added benefit. Hibiscus, Rose of Sharon. That's a late season bloomer and a great option, and they'll nectar on those flowers as well.
And I'm assuming that all of those plants that you're talking about also attract other kinds of pollinators.
You're right. You know, when you do start looking for plants, you know, hummingbirds are after the nectar and so are many of the insects. And so it's a great way to help attract many of those. You know, a lot of the bees, our native bees, are so important and often overlooked. They typically are attracted to bright white flowers, yellows and blues. Some are very specific. There's a great native bee handout on UW. I think it's on UW Extension's website. But if you do UW native bee identification, you'll come up. It's got great pictures, talks about the flowers and how to support the native bees. The mason bees are important pollinators of our fruit plants. So they love those crab apples. One of the birds that I just learned about that was a pollinator is Baltimore Orioles. I've had them here for a couple of weeks, but they call them accidental pollinators. They go after the same plants as hummingbirds, and they're kind of messy when they're getting the nectar, and they accidentally pollinate. So that's kind of fun.
Yeah, because there's a difference, right? I mean, their nectar is what they're looking for on some of them. Others, it's pollen, but they all manage to pollinate. Do I have that right?
Right.
Okay.
It's very well. Yes. Very good. Very good. And we often kind of, it's, you know, and my feeling is if you're attracting hummingbirds, you're doing all the right things, like you mentioned, to support the pollinators. You're avoiding pesticides because that can be harmful to our good insects that often help manage our problem insects and that do pollination and that our songbirds and hummingbirds eat. And so we're trying to have a healthy environment. Lots of flowers that we can enjoy, bloom spring through fall, as you mentioned, helping them on that migration heading south, getting those fall bloomers, things that our pollinators need too before they either migrate or hibernate, like goldenrod, asters. Those are great pollinator plants as well. And then just having the habitat. I think we keep learning more. One of the reasons I love what I do and I love working in this field and with gardeners is we learn something new every season.
True.
And, you know, I always let my perennial stand for winter. Increases hardiness. I like the winter interest, seeds for the birds. Then we learn that a lot of beneficial insects overwintered in the hollow stems. Now we're finding in the last few years that native bees overwinter in dead stems in the summer. So when you cut back your garden, leave some of those stems 18 to 24 inches, and a lot of our native bees will spend the summer there. New growth masks it, and probably a lot of gardeners listening have already cleaned up their gardens, unlike me. But put that note down for next year, right?
There you go.
That leaves some standing. And then that way, you'll take care of them. The new growth hides it. That disintegrates over winter and adds organic matter to the soil. So it just helps our gardens and it helps those native bees as well.
Well, I guess I'm ahead of the trends because I've always kind of done that, mostly because I was too lazy to haul it away. But, you know, sometimes lazy gardening works.
I'm with you. I want to call it low input, Jill. I want to start a new club, the Low Input Gardeners. It sounds so much better than being lazy.
I like that. I will join. I will definitely.
Okay.
Yeah. Only if you have a decoder ring, though. So.
I'll have to work on
that. Yeah, so if you have a question about hummingbirds or attracting pollinators or pretty much any other gardening question, you can give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. And we did get an email from Lynn Wolt in Cedarburg. She emailed to say that 40 large daffodils were bought in the fall of 2023 and planted at a Cedarburg cemetery, and they bloomed extraordinarily in the spring of 2024. But this spring, nothing appeared. Lynn said that they dug up the plot and found all the bulbs at the appropriate depth of 6 inches. It says feet, but I'm sure it's 6 inches. And that 10 of them were very soft, but 30 of them were still hard, but starting to soften with small shoots showing. The roots seem to be fine. So do you have any explanation for what could have happened?
You know, I lost some of my bulbs we had so much rain last year. You know, we were averaging, parts of Wisconsin were averaging like 8 inches a month. And then we had nothing come fall. And so a lot of plants put on really lush growth. Then we had the drought stress. Looking at the UW Plant Disease Diagnostic Lab Almanac, I'm seeing some root rot on perennials. So I'm wondering, those soft bulbs, maybe just in Cedarburg, I know Mequon area tends to have very heavy clay, and even if you amend it, it takes years to fix. So I'm wondering if the soils were waterlogged and maybe the main bulbs were dying back, and the bulblets, where she's getting smaller bulbs with shoots, are going to make it and at least send up leaves. One of the problems I see with daffodils, but usually you get growth, is the early ones send up their leaves. And then, you know, the flower stem almost looks like a leaf, and just the tip is swollen. Yeah. And if we get a cold snap as it's starting to expand, that kills the flower, but not the plant. So I'm guessing we're going to blame the weather on this one. But if she's got, and you know, she did the right thing. So thank you, Lynn, because it's underground what's happening. So I think getting rid of the soft ones, replanting those that have healthy roots and some shoot sowing, you're obviously not going to get blooms this year. But if they put up some leaves, that's going to help put energy back into the bulbs. And then if you're replanting, you may want to make sure that maybe add a little more compost to the area, even if you amended before, would be a good idea as well if you replant this fall. But I think she's done all the right things. And sometimes, you know, this is going to be a weird year with an open winter, very dry for most of the state. And it's going to be one of those, we need to start keeping track of what's doing well. We may be changing some of our planting habits, extreme heat in the summer, torrential downpours, droughty periods, you know, winter's a little different. So, you know, this is where taking some notes, taking pictures with your phone as a record, anything to kind of track what's doing well and maybe things to avoid or things, wow, that one's doing great. We'll add some more of those.
Yeah, that's a wonderful idea. And I always think I should do that and I forget. But, you know, and that's also too, it's like, okay, where do I plant my new bulbs? Where do I have the ones from last year? Because I forgot. And, you know.
You know, and I have dug up, and I just say replant them when you dig in the fall, and you go, and we all mark them, right?
Right.
And then we lose the mark, or we have good intentions,
mm-hmm.
and, it, you know, they're pretty tough, fortunately, so you're not alone. That's another item on our low-input gardening agenda.
Exactly, you're not alone. We're talking with Melinda Myers, and what questions do you have for her? She can take pretty much anything, so give us a call. Lines are all open, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And this is Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Our guest today is Melinda Myers. What questions do you have? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Keith emailed us to say that cleavers are invading their yard and wants to know how to stop them. Pulling by hand with nitrile gloves works, but there are too many. Any suggestions? Herbicides are not an option because Keith has intermingled hostas in that area.
And he said,
cleavers. Cleavers? I've never heard of that before.
I have not either. So, well, almost so much you can answer almost anything. I'm kind of doing a quick search here to see sometimes we all know plants by different names.
Right.
When I first moved here, somebody somebody wanted some Oahu and a Funkia, and I had to look it up. And Oahu, a type of euonymus, and a Funkia was a name for a hosta, which I'd never heard.
No,
so cleavers is an herb. Oh, galium. It's a type of in the bedstraw family.
Ah.
So I've never heard it by that name. So so here's the deal. If it's intermingled with plants, and I get it, not wanting to use chemicals, then the bad news is digging consistently or cutting it off as soon as it emerges and making sure you get all of the sprouts and keeping after it, because they can sneak up and, you know, the spread that great nutrients they've produced in the leaves back into the roots to the other plants. So I get it. So, well, I learned something new today. Thank you, Keith.
Yeah, me too.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm sorry you don't, I don't have a better option. One of the issues when we go chemical free, and I, you know, I've got the weeds to prove I'm doing that too, pulling, trying to get as much of the root, mulching the soil will help with annual weeds, help improve the growth of your perennials. And if your soil's really compacted or, you know, not great, and you need to boost the growth of your perennials, top dressing. They found top dressing with an inch of compost every other year, every third year, is enough nutrients for many perennials. So you don't even need to fertilize. So that can help. Using an auger bit on your cordless drill to aerate the soil also will help in the push some of that compost in if your perennials are slowing down. So that might be a way to boost the health of your perennials while you continually pull or cut back the cleavers.
Do you think that planting those hostas closer together, I don't know how close they are, but will that help to create the shade where those weeds might not come in?
You know, there's a whole new trend, and I'm buying some sedges this year because I need to beef up some of the cover in my gardens, but called living mulches, using other plants. So either putting them closer together, then we're always risking that whole disease issue. But sedges are very popular, and there are many that are shade tolerant, a little more airier. Their texture looks great with hostas, so you're creating some diversity and adding some interesting texture and doing exactly what you're recommending, Jill, is covering that soil. So one of the practices, and I know they're doing this at Olbrich Botanic Garden. I heard their perennial gardener speak, and she inspired me that I need to do this, is they're using a lot of living mulches, using sedges, putting them close together to fill in those spaces to shade out the soil, protect the soil, and help suppress unwanted plants like this.
Yes, we're always learning something new, and that is certainly one of them. Let's go to Sandra in the Wisconsin Dells. Go ahead, Sandra.
Hi. I'm in the process of trying to change the landscape of my garden. It's a home we moved into 2 years ago, and they had rock around the house with plastic underneath, and I've been trying to remove that and beef up the soil, and also other grass areas in the yard to turn into more wildlife, wild plants areas. But my question is weed suppression. And I think you were just kind of hitting on some things that gave me ideas. But how to do that in a more nature-friendly way?
Yes. So a couple of things. Yay for removing rocks and plastic mulch. Because I bet as you pull it up, you see that plastic is one of the worst things we can put on our soil, and organic mulches are better. Now, if you are using rock mulch, you want at least weed barriers under there so it doesn't filter in and then you're digging rocks forever. But better to use organic mulches because as they break down, they improve the soil. If you're doing chemical-free, I've had great success where I've marked out a bed, edged the garden, cut the grass and weeds very, very short, and then covering it with newspaper or cardboard. There has been some debate from a professor out in the Pacific Northwest, but I've had great success with cardboard and met very many gardeners who've done the same. And so doing that and covering with wood chips or grass clippings not treated with weed killers or leaves And then give it time to die back. You can cut through and plant, but boy, it's pretty hard to cut through that turf until it's dead. But eventually what happens is the grass and weeds die. They're smothered by the cardboard. The cardboard eventually breaks down, and the mulch then is available, and it'll eventually break down. I did this around my spruce trees to expand the mulch bed, and I didn't have weeds for 7 years, and it worked great. And then it improved the soil as time went on. So I met a guy who, this might be interesting for you, he does ecological restorations. And if you're doing native plantings, the first few years are the hardest, right? Because you've got all that weed seed in the ground. And what he says he does, and he has luck, I have not done this, but he kind of prepares the site the same way, mowing it short, edging the bed, throwing down cardboard, covering it with compost. Now that's a can you get enough compost to do it? And he plants the seed right in the compost. And so he said he's had good luck doing this and getting the plantings established and minimizing the weeds, because otherwise you need to cultivate every month for 2 years to help deal with some of those perennial weeds, or use a total vegetation killer to try to kill those weeds so that you've got a good starting point when you do plant your seeds or your native plants. Prairie Nursery, which is in Westfield, Wisconsin, on his website, he has great information on, you know, soil preparation and weed control and those options, as well as the plants if you're looking for starting a native garden. But anytime we can use those resources on our landscape, don't rake the leaves to the curb in the fall. Bag them and save them for spring for mulching if you need to, and you don't want to mulch in the fall. They make great mulch for your perennial garden. Tuck them under your trees and shrubs. Save them, throw them in the compost pile, leave them on the lawn, and chop them with the mower. But those are great organic matter. That's great organic matter. Dig it into your annual gardens in fall. By spring, it's broken down and you've improved the soil. So lots of ways to help fix the soil, because most of us start with lousy soil.
Yep, that's very true. Thanks for the question, Sandra. I really appreciate that. If you've got one for Melinda, give us a call, 800-642-1234. Melinda, I have a feeling a lot of people are outside gardening today.
I know. That's where you and I are going after this.
Yes, more than likely. Cindy in Stevens Point emailed to ask if a full sun dwarf bush or tree is recommended to attract hummingbirds. Apparently she needs a recommendation for one.
So some trees that you could, so full sun, well, let's see, and I don't know how big she's going to want that.
Dwarf bush or tree, so it's got to be fairly small, I would think.
Okay, so lilacs are great. Hummingbirds love them. I have a feeder next to my lilac and my honeysuckle vine, and so they get a little sip of nectar from the feeder, then they work on the lilac and the honeysuckle vine. Thank you for the reminder on that. I mentioned Rose of Sharon. Some of the newer ones don't reseed as readily as some of the older ones, and that would give you some of that late season interest. Weigela is very drought tolerant. I have some planted around my property, and I see the hummingbirds out there nectaring. They tend to bloom a lot in mid to late spring, and some sporadically throughout the growing season, and then kind of a last hurrah in the fall, so they provide some ongoing support. Our native Dervilla, which is called dwarf honeysuckle or bush honeysuckle. It's not the bad one. It blooms in the summer, and that's a nice one for hummingbirds as well. Clethra or summer sweet, there are some that are 4 to 5 feet tall, which may be better. There are some that are smaller, just a couple of feet tall. Those are excellent. Azaleas, you're kind of in the, you know, you'd want to do one of the northern lights azaleas that are a lot hardier for your area. For most of Wisconsin, they like moist, well-drained, acidic soil, so you might need to mulch it to keep it moist, but you have the acidic soil, a little bit of shelter. You said full sun. That could be a little stressful on it if you can't keep it watered, so maybe save that for one of those poor sheltered areas. Service berries usually are a little bit earlier bloomer than our hummingbirds make it up here. You may even see them on some crab apples, but again, it depends. We just saw our first hummingbirds a week ago, so I'm guessing they're headed your way, Cindy. They may have made it by now. So those are some that I think you'd want to try that would be good for those full sun. The honeysuckle vine, the calathra, the weigela, the lilac, the hibiscus, either the summer hibiscus, which can get pretty big, like 4 or 5 feet tall, the hardy hibiscus, or the Rose of Sharon, which is more tree-like, and then select the variety that works well. Those will all take that sunshine.
Okay, thanks for the email. In that kind of that vein, and I'm not quite sure if this fits into your vast knowledge or not, but Mark in New Glarus emailed to say that he's asked if having more hummingbird feeders will attract more hummingbirds. He has as many as 5, and it doesn't seem to bring in any more.
You know, they are very territorial, and we have feeders on either end of the front of our house, and we watch them fight. I keep going, there's food on the backyard, too. Go over there. So making sure that you have them spaced out properly, having plenty of flowers nearby. And so sometimes it takes a while for them to find you, too. You know, I have a lot of people go, I've been putting out feeders for a year and I don't have any hummingbirds. And so that's one of the things to be important. They like a somewhat sheltered location. You know, a little bit of shade never hurts. And water. You know, I forgot to mention how important water is for our pollinators, our hummingbirds. I work with Birds in Bloom magazine, and one of my jobs is to look at all the photos with plants in it. What a great job.
Oh, gee, that's rough.
I know. Somebody sent a photo in of a hummingbird sipping at a bird bath next to some bees and butterflies. They were all lined up along the edge. It was great. So shallow, sloping sides, because that makes it easy for those pollinators and even the birds to take a sip when they don't want to take a bath, or putting some stones into the bottom of your bird bath and moving water misters. Hummingbirds like misting, so that might really help them out in terms of when it gets really hot and bring them out to see. Now, I have to tell you, Mark, I have never seen a hummingbird nest. This is one of my goals. I don't know if I, you know, we kind of look at where they're flying, what trees, and go searching, but we haven't found any. But, yeah, I think it's a matter of keeping them far apart, keeping them clean, and they will eventually find them. But they are very territorial, so kind of keep that in mind.
Okay, and then one more with hummingbird feeders. Now, Sue emailed that she heard that you should put your hummingbird feeder away after the spring, and she's wondering, is that true?
You know, Kim and Kimberly Kaufman are the bird experts at Birds in Bloom, so I always feel like I need to be careful. You know, I leave mine up. A lot of people will leave them up throughout the season. The key is keeping them clean. And sometimes the advice given is, well, rather than take chances of people not changing them out every 2 to 3 days when the temperatures rise, that it's safer to put them away and there's plenty of food. I have lots of plants that attract hummingbirds. I see them nectaring, but I also see them sipping out of the feeders as well. So cleanliness is the important thing. I have not seen any research that shows that's a good idea. But you bring up a good point, is spring is an important time to feed birds because our landscapes don't have as much food sources, right? Think about a lot of the plants that they depend upon are just starting to grow here. The seed source is depleted from winter. We do have some leftover fruit on some of the crab apples, but most of the birds have cleaned that up. And so this is an important time for feeders. And then if you don't want to feed in the summer, and again, keeping the feeders for anything clean is important, then putting them away for the summer, as long as you have other food source. And then fall is the other important time when they're migrating back through, making sure there's plenty of food, whether it's your plants or the feeders.
Okay, great. Thank you very much for that question. And let's go to Anne in Madison. Go right ahead, Anne.
Hi. I was wondering about that purple campanella that spreads aggressively. It's really pretty, but I've been fighting with it for years trying to get rid of it because it is so aggressive. Is there anything you can do with that?
Yeah, that is considered, it's the running bell flower, and I'm going to put a plug in for the Wisconsin DNR website because it is on there. And one of the things, all those invasive plants that are either restricted or limited, and I'm guessing this is the one you're talking about. And so you've probably tried to dig it, but you need to go at least 6 inches deep and several inches out from the plant to make sure you get all of the roots, and then continually pulling or mowing throughout the growing season will weaken the plant, but it won't kill it. The other option is using a total vegetation killer, but you'll want to do that wicket on or protect your nearby plants. If it's in, I'm guessing it's probably in your flower bed, and you want to protect your nearby plants so you don't kill them. And that's why a broadleaf weed killer is not recommended in flower beds because it'll knock out your flowers, your desirable plants as well. And so that's kind of the only option, I'm afraid. It's really tough. And then Mark Renz, who is with UW-Madison, he's got a great series of fact sheets that he talks about different invasive plants, including the creeping bell flower. And you're right, it is one of the really toughest. And he talks about how to identify it, and then if you're going to treat, how to treat, and any cautions you should consider. So if you go to the Wisconsin DNR website, and what I do is just Wisconsin DNR and type in the plant, it's the easiest way to get there. They have links to all of his fact sheets as well. But really what you're doing, it's just being more persistent, which I realize is not easy. I have crown vetch that's invaded my garden beds, and it's yes, I feel your pain. It's not purple.
Yes.
Yes.
I have Japanese knotweed that's on my list of things to do this weekend.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. It's crazy. And if anybody wants to call up and tell me I should eat it, yeah, right.
Come and harvest it while you,
you
dig
come
it
and
out
get
of your
it.
Garden,
that's right. Oh, my God. If it was two plants, I would be fine. It's not.
Yes.
So.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So do your homework before you put plants in, for sure.
And we all have learned. I mean, these are a problem because they used to be low maintenance, easy care, long blooming, and we all put them in, a lot of them, not all of them, because we thought they were good, and now we found out they're not, and they're taking over. So.
Yep, exactly.
Yes, but now do your homework, because we're doing, I think, a better job of being proactive.
Yeah,
hopefully.
And we've got a lot of great resources, too, like you had mentioned, the DNR, the extension. There's just so much good information out there. So let's go back to the phones, and over in Sturgeon Bay, we've got Stella. Go ahead, Stella.
Hey, Melissa, when you were talking about many different ways to use your leaves in the fall to fall down from your trees, I just wanted to offer another way that we use. We live in town. We have chickens, and what we do is we gather the leaves from our yard in a neighbor's yard. We put them in the winter pen for the chickens to about mid-thigh deep on us. And then all winter long, the chicken, we throw food scraps out and feed and scratch. And all winter long, the chickens scratch and mix up, and they poop out there, and they mix it all together. And it's called a deep litter system. It has the real advantage in town of there is no smell associated with it. And then in the spring, we move the chickens to their summer quarters, and we clear all of those leaves out, compost them over the summer, and then that gives us the potting soil that we use for starting our plants in the spring.
Wow,
oh,
that's impressive.
That is great.
Yes.
Thank you. I have a friend that has chickens. I'll have to share that with her because, boy, they poop a lot. So this is a great way to manage that. and especially in an urban setting. Thank you, Stella. I really appreciate it because I know a lot of people are raising chickens now, and I am not. My neighbor does, so I need eggs. I just go to her house.
Oh, that's nice.
I know. So that's great. I'm going to check that out. But thank you, Stella. That's excellent.
Thank you very much. Well, we're talking to nationally known gardening expert Melinda Myers. If you've got any questions for her, give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. And this is Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. We're talking to Melinda Myers today. If you've got a question about gardening, give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. And stay with us in the last 30 minutes of the show today. We're going to be talking a little bit about vegetables. And we do have a hummingbird-related comment from Christine in Bear Lake Township. Go ahead, Christine.
Yes, hi. We're about 12 miles north of Rice Lake, so we're in the north part of the country. And we take our hummingbird and all bird feeders in early in the spring because we have bears. And the only alternative to that is to take them in at night, but at the same time, you don't want to attract them during the day.
Good point.
So we have to take our feeders in.
Yeah, very good point.
Yes, I'm glad. One of the fun things I mentioned, I get to look at pictures for when we, you know, review the issues for birds in bloom. And when I'm feeling bad about the deer, I see the moose, the bear, and I'm like, okay, I can't complain. So thank you for sharing that, because I do talk to a lot of gardeners that bring them in at night and put their feeders out during the day. But you're right. That's where, depending on the plants and the environment, is really a good alternative. And I just wanted to mention, too, I'm doing an Attracting Hummingbirds webinar on June 4th. It's free to attend, part of our library series. So I'll be talking about lots of plants and other things to, you know, some of the things we've discussed today about attracting hummingbirds and helping give you ideas how to include those plants in your landscape.
That's right. And we were going to talk about that a little bit later, but we can talk about it now. It's no problem. So tell us a little bit more. This is, you've been doing this for a number of years now, haven't you?
I have, thanks to our sponsorship from We Energies. We team up with the public libraries of Wisconsin and the UP of Michigan, but everyone is welcome to listen. But libraries are so important to our communities. And so we've teamed up with them. So every month, April, May, and June, I've done a webinar, and all the recordings are available. Just come to my website, and there's a link there, and the handouts, which are very detailed with lots of helpful links. And then we do an activity every month and a video. And so this month it was all about vertical gardening. So I'll show you how to build a couple of easy, sort of easy vertical gardens. And last week we did the webinar. And then June, we're in the process of editing our video on good guys, the managers, the pest managers in nature. So the birds, the toads, all those predaceous insects. And then the webinar is hummingbirds. And because of our sponsorship, we can offer this for free. We have gardeners from all over the country. We have libraries. Check with your local library, because some of them do viewing parties, some have reading lists, some have additional activities. The libraries are just full of creative staff that really have helped us reach a lot more people, and we're very grateful for the partnership and the sponsorship as well.
Yeah, libraries are amazing. If you haven't been for a while, you need to check it out. So just as important as public radio, public media,
actually. Exactly. Yeah. So they all need our support
right now.
Right. That's all I'll say.
And let's go to Nancy in Salem. Go ahead, Nancy.
Hello. Good morning. I am wondering, I want to get a yard of compost. I'm wondering if there is any value in getting mushroom compost, or should I just go for soil compost?
So here's a couple things with compost is finding out, one, if you know anyone who's purchased it, ask for their feedback. Did it work? You know, there's not a whole lot of regulations on compost, so it could be very valuable or not. I've used mushroom compost in the past. There was some concern about the salt buildup from, you know, it's from the, you know, the whole process. I never had that experience. One of the concerns we have with compost, and I hate to even say the word jumping worm, but finding out, you've talked about this a lot,
yes.
haven't you? It's an invasive worm that eats organic matter and destroys the soil structure. And Wisconsin UW Landscape Arboretum has been doing some surveying, some citizen science things, trying to find plants that are surviving well. Not a lot of controls. You can monitor using ground must, dried mustard, and water. There is a Wormicide Botanigard, but it's expensive and not 100%. But University of Maryland has an interesting publication where they talk about treating it. Because when I was looking to buy some soil when we did some improvement in our landscape, I opted not to, you know, find out how are they managing for jumping worm weeds and other things. You know, if they're storing it on soil, where the raw materials, is it, are they checking for them? Do they even know what they are? The other thing you can do is University of Maryland talks about is laying down a sheet of plastic, a 6 to 8 inch layer of compost or mulch, whatever you're trying to do, fold over the plastic so you're making a plastic pocket, and then monitor the temperature. And when it's 105 degrees for 3 days straight, that will kill the cocoons and the eggs and any adults. So if you're worried about bringing in anything else. Blended potting topsoil mixes sometimes have more weed seeds, so that is why a lot of experts are recommending bringing in compost. It does great things. So I would just ask what their process is for dealing with weed seed and maybe the jumping worms or any other things you don't want to introduce. Some compost processes are very hot, and they turn, and they manage, and they really take care of all those problems, disease, and weeds. Some are a little more casual, like a lot of ours in our backyard, where you throw it in a pile and you eventually harvest it. But it doesn't get hot enough to kill some of those organisms. So I think asking those questions of the place you're purchasing it will help you make a decision as well. And from friends who have purchased from those companies, too. Were they happy? Did they have good results? Did they like the quality of the product?
Thank you for the question, Nancy. And that's so true. Not all compost is created equal. You know, will that, you know, envelope of heating the compost take care of the weed seeds too, or is it just the critters?
Well, 105 is just enough for the jumping worm critters. You really need to get it up to, I think it's 140 degrees. Ooh. It'll take care of a lot of those. Yeah. So that's where a hot compost works well. You know, if you let it heat up to that amount, and the reason we're doing that thin layer, so that's, you know, the heat will go from top to bottom. But yes, you're right. Weed seeds are an issue. I think, you know, we've all sometimes bought in topsoil that was worse than what we started with,
yeah.
right? And so, you know, and that's why a lot of there's good quality companies out there, like any business, and there's some that, you know, have a more casual approach
there
and maybe you don't want their product.
Yes, there you go. Thanks for that question, Nancy. Kent in Reedstown emailed to say that he's trying to establish ornamental tobacco from seed, but he is having no luck. Any tips?
You know, this is one of those plants where if you get once you get the ornamental tobacco, Nicotiana, growing in your garden, it drops seeds, it reseeds readily, and you'll have lots of seedlings. But when you try to start it indoors, it can be a challenge. And so a couple things I find, a warm place to germinate your seeds. That's one of the things I find. Like my peppers are so slow, and I start my seeds in my spare bathroom. I have shelves. I keep the door closed. It's the warmest room I have. Bottom heat can help as well. Even planting them directly in the garden, they're going to bloom later. Now, the problem with letting them reseed, if they're hybrids, they could be taller or shorter than what you started with. So that's the downside. But the upside is they're free seeds, and they come back a lot easier. So I would evaluate where you're starting them. Are they staying moist enough? Are they, but not too wet? Is it warm enough where you're sprouting them so that they have success? You might want to try winter sowing. I have not done that with Nicotiana, but that would be another thing to try, where you take milk jugs. It's a little late for now, but for next year, some milk jugs. And then they go outside in probably, since it's an annual March, kind of February, March time frame, and that becomes your little mini greenhouse as well. I'm growing garden huckleberries, and I have to tell you, honestly, I have two little seedlings that are pathetic. I'm seeding it. I'm going to plant them in the garden. I had better luck with that direct seeding than I did starting them indoors. So sometimes it's just changing the way we do business.
Yeah, because some of those little seedlings are a lot more sensitive to being moved than others, it seems.
Exactly. And always check the seed pack. It gives you good information, too, on planting depth, on the growing conditions. I find, though, now a lot of seed companies aren't including it on their seed packet, but you go to their website. And I get that, reducing cost. And
sure.
So sometimes, you know, look for those details on their website as well.
Mm-hmm. You know, you had mentioned the webinar that you did on vertical gardening or are going to do. That has always been very intriguing to me. Why don't you talk a little bit about that, maybe explain what it is for those who aren't familiar and how it works?
You know, the benefit of vertical gardening is saving space. I was a city gardener for quite a while, so every square inch had to provide value, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it also is a great way of not only saving space, but creating screens, kind of a friendly screen from your neighbor if it's a plant versus, you know, a board-on-board fence, or dressing up that fence so it's a prettier sight to look at. Reducing disease problems, training cucumbers and squash and melons. It increases airflow and light penetration, reducing the risk of disease. Just sling the heavy fruit. You know, it used to be old nylon stockings, but most of us don't have to wear those anymore. Chicago Botanic Garden had macrame slings, so, you know, it's kind of trendy now. Anything to hold it to the support because you don't want it ripping off the vine. And you can do this in your garden and your ornamental garden because you just get a pretty obelisk or support or make your own, and it can be very attractive. And, you know, pole beans, you'll get more pickings out of pole beans, but easier to pick as well. And so going vertical, that's one way. The other thing is to create a planter. So one of the things I did is I took old blue jeans that were headed to the textile recycling, and I made pouches that could be hung on a fence, or we just had an old piece of wood we preserved and put some screws in, and so that'll be mounted on a wall to look probably at State Fair, so come visit me. Pallet planters are popular. You can either make one where you use landscape fabric to create pouches to plant in, or what we did is I just took a corner of one of the pallets, put some hose clamps on it, and small pots would rest in there, planted those, and that could be mounted on a fence or wall. You could do a big planter, but mine's traveling, so I wanted to go small. But just a way of repurposing items, and even in containers, you can grow your vines in a pot. So it's a great way if you only have a balcony or a deck to garden on that you could create that screen. And lots of nice vertical plants. So that was last week, but the recording is available. So go to my website under upcoming live events and webinars. There's a watch webinars on demand, and click on that and just scroll through to find the webinar you want. And there's a link, and it's free to watch and hopefully give you some ideas of not only things I've done, but other gardeners, because there's so many creative people out there doing really cool things.
Oh, yes. I found quite a few on Pinterest that I, you know, I was like, I really like to do this, right? So Melinda's website is Melinda Myers, MYERS.com, right?
Right, exactly. So, yes, please check it out. And if you've sent me a question, send it again. I know I'm behind and I'm working on it. So please be patient with me.
And there's so much really good stuff on there. So even if you don't have a specific question in mind, just go and check it out or sign up for your newsletter. I get that. And I really like that.
Well, thank you. And if you have suggestions for future webinars or in-person appearances, I'm always happy. These are meant to help you. And so please always share. I love to hear from gardeners when I'm out and about, and appreciate suggestions and ideas.
Okay, wonderful. Well, don't go too far, because Melinda will be back after the news, and stay with us until the end, or the half hour in. And I'll get to those callers when we get back. So hold on. Thanks. This is Garden Talk, excuse me, on the Larry Mueller Show. I am Jill Nadeau. Thanks for joining us today. And we've been talking with Melinda Myers. She's a nationally known gardening expert, TV and radio host, author, and columnist with over 30 years of horticulture experience. What gardening questions are on your mind? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And let's go to Dave in Appleton, who's been waiting for a very long time. Thanks for your patience, Dave. Go right ahead.
Oh, not at all. I appreciate you taking my call. I have to apologize. I know you covered this already, but I missed some of it, and I have more questions on it. To be able to kill a lawn that has weed in it, dandelions, thistle, and quack grass, and it's about 15 by 45. Do I put just cardboard down? And if so, how thick, like an inch of cardboard? And do I have to keep replacing the cardboard because it's going to biodegrade? Should I put maybe plywood on top to hold it down? What can I do without chemicals to completely kill all of that, to start over new? And how long will it take? The rest of this year, maybe all of next year?
And Dave, are you still there? What do you want to put new grass in there, new lawn grass, or a garden bed?
All garden bed, all flowers, and maybe very low to the ground prairie plants that only grow as high as maybe Creeping Charlie, stuff like that. But I want to start fresh because of all the quack and dandelions and thistle and such.
Thank you. Okay, so here's the thing. A couple things that are important, so I may have either forgotten or I want to reiterate. One is, if you've got an area, you want to edge that, because if you're going to do smothering to kill existing weeds and lawn, you don't want them getting support from the weeds on the outside of that area. And so edging that bed and looking at some of the, I'm fighting not only crown veg, but the old bindweed. And some of the recommendations, too, are having actually another foot around your garden bed of maybe just mulch, so that as those weeds start to infiltrate, you've got kind of that foot, you know, barrier, but also a chance to get after them as well and keep that edge intact. So edging helps to do that, so they're not getting fed from the outside. Plastic or black landscape fabric is recommended for 1 to 2 years. I'd avoid the plastic, but the black landscape fabric. But I prefer to use cardboard. Remove the tape and staples, otherwise you'll be pulling it out of the garden. I know this from experience. And, you know, most of us don't even have newspapers anymore, right? It's all mostly digital. So cardboard, usually one layer is sufficient. As I mentioned, I mulched this area around my spruce trees. I was just doing mulch, so I put down cardboard with wood chips, and the wood chips were heavy enough. But you could use landscape pins, too, if you're in a windy area, to help hold it in place. But I find if you do a mulch, that's usually good. I would probably, if you can, wait at least a year. Sometimes cardboard, one layer will be plenty, and that usually smothers the weeds and the grass. Remembering that, you know, you may get some coming in from the outside, but usually one layer of cardboard, any kind of mulch. You might want to do wood chips if you did it now, so that it had the whole summer and through the winter, and then next spring do your planting. You'll have a lot easier time getting through. If there is any cardboard left, you can cut through. As I mentioned before, some people are putting compost down and planting. There's a gentleman out of the UK who does a no-till method, where he does cardboard, 5 to 6 inches of compost, And he plants right into that and then just adds more compost each year. I did a blog for Milorganite, so if you go to their website and look at No Dig Gardening, I talk about various ways to improve your soil without getting out the tiller. And I have a link to his information that goes through his process as well as an outline on in that article. So you might want to check that out for more detail. But I think if you can start now, if you don't mind looking at it for the whole summer, you'll have better success if you put the cardboard down. Maybe just use some wood chip mulch because they're a little heavier than, say, leaves or grass clippings. I live in a pretty windy area, and I mulched some beds with leaves in the fall. The next day, the winds were high, and it was in the farm field. So that was my mistake. But I think that will help you, Dave. And if you're really worried, some landscape pins on the wind side. But otherwise, I think that will give you some good results and knock it down. And then by next spring, that gives you all this year to plan what you want to put in there. Place your order, talk to your garden center, find out what will be available.
Excellent. Thank you, Dave, and good luck with that. Not an easy task, yeah. But well worth it, I'm
no.
sure. Yeah. Let's go to Laura in Manitowoc next. Go ahead, Laura.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. So we have a small tree. I believe it's just a regular maple tree, and it was cut down all the way down to the ground a year ago. And as often happens, it has all these shoots coming up now from the bottom, you know, and it looks very vibrant. And we've enjoyed it this last year just kind of as a maple bush. But we're wondering, can you take a tree like that and rejuvenate it? Can it actually grow back into a tree? And if so, how do we prune that? Do we cut out selective branches? Do we cut out all but one branch? What's the hope for the future for this plant?
Yeah, great idea. So if it was a small maple, you want to make sure it wasn't an amur maple, which has kind of arrowhead-shaped leaves, because they found that that's invasive and lots of seeds and seedlings. So, you know, since it's in the rejuvenation period, you may decide maybe we'll replace it with something better. But if you want to train this to be a tree, yes, you can do that. And so typically when they first sprout from the ground, we pick the strongest one and train that to be our new trunk and remove all the other branches. And pruning not only removes growth, but stimulates growth. So now that you've got this maple bush, it sounds like, if you pick the strongest one, you may want to just reduce the height of those surrounding it, and then over time get them down to the ground, make sure that one stem, or if you cut them all back to the ground, pick the strongest one, and you'll have to keep after it because it's probably going to keep sending up those additional stems. But eventually you can train that into your main trunk to grow into a tree as well, especially if it's looking healthy. I'm not sure why you cut it down, and as long as it wasn't a disease issue, you know, but keeping a tall tree small over time can be difficult. So if you removed it, you know, cut it ground level because of either a disease problem or it was too big for the spot, it's going to grow to be too big again. So kind of keep that in mind as you start spending some effort trying to retrain it into a tree.
Ooh, well, good luck, Laura. She kept it as a bush, what would happen eventually?
Well, it's gonna keep sending up lots of stems. So, you know, you're going to have a bigger bush. And so you're going to have to continually reduce the height on that. Mm. But that might be one, you know, kind of depending on the tree, and it's, you know, you're going to have multiple stems. They're going to be more weak-wooded. When you think about a tree, we have a trunk, and we have branches that come out at, you know, perpendicular to that trunk. So that's a strong attachment. Sometimes when we get lots of stems coming up, you know, what's happening with those individual stems? Are they putting out branches? Is it going to be too dense? So you may need to do some thinning, kind of like you do with the lilac that gets overgrown.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be one of those, you're going to have to continually manage it either way, you know, whether you're retraining it to be a tree or you're trying to manage it as a bush, you're going to have to do some regular pruning to try to accomplish the size and the shape that you want and keep it healthy.
Okay, great. Thank you. Stuart in Token Creek called. He couldn't stay with us, but he wanted to know if peonies can be divided and replanted. And my question to follow up, when's the best time to do that?
Yes. So, yes, you can. Peonies are usually very long-lived, so they can stay in the same spot for 100 years and not need any division. So we usually divide them or dig and move them because we need to do that, not because the plant. Typically, we do that in the fall as the plant turns yellow and dies back. You can do it in the spring. You know, you won't get the blooms. Typically, if we dig and divide in the spring on spring-flowering plants, we interfere with the bloom, which, you know, even when you move them in the fall, sometimes you don't get flowers the next year. So the key thing not only is timing, but make sure the growing point is no more than 2 inches below the soil surface, because that can interfere with flowering and gets, and that plant will receive full sun or good, you know, good 6 to 8 hours of sunlight a day to get good flowering.
Okay. Now, I have a whole row of peonies. It's been there for a very long time. I don't know if it's 100 years, but it's probably pretty close. But they're starting to get the donut shape where there's nothing in the middle. Does that mean that they have to be broken up or...
Yeah, that's a good sign. And so you'd have a couple of options. You could divide off the part, you know, that, okay, that looks good. I'm going to dig that and move it to another place. You could dig the whole clump and remove the dense center. That's not always typical of peonies, but it can happen with any plant. Iris, Siberian iris are, I think, the most popular, right? Donut shape, time to move them. So that is a good thing. So dividing perennials in general, poor flowering, the dead center, like you mentioned, Jill, floppy growth, not that they normally don't have, or they've outgrown the location. I usually like to do the, kind of the old rule of thumb, if it blooms in the fall, divide in the spring, blooms in the spring, divide in the fall. Tracy DeSabato Oust, who wrote The Well-Tended Perennial Garden, divides her spring bloomers right after flowering so she gets to enjoy them. But you need to make sure you can take good care of them that summer because we're going into the heat of summer. And you need to make sure you can give them the TLC they need as we move into the more stressful summer months when you've just newly divided a plant.
Okay. Jerry in Prairie du Chien emailed to say that his garlic garden is pretty well packed with volunteer garlic, and the bulbs are no larger than the nail of your little finger. The garlic is now starting to send out scapes, I'm assuming.
Oh, yes.
The seed-bearing pods. Could he be cutting those to so that the plant's energy goes into the bulb? What should he do at that point?
Great question, Jerry. So there's been some research and kind of mixed results that removing the scapes does help send that energy into the bulb. The scapes can be used. You probably know that, but a lot of people may not. You use them. It's a milder flavor of garlic. It definitely won't hurt to remove those. It may not give you the results you want. I too, always find, I think I do a good job digging my garlic, and I always find a few strays. So you probably, I would say, do that because the bulbs are small, and then you can use those scapes when, you know, use those scapes, and then hopefully that will allow the plant to put some more energy back in. Worst case, you have small garlic that you want to use right away, and maybe, you know, when you harvest it, use up the small ones first, and you'll still have lots of good flavor.
There you go. Those scapes can be used sort of like, well, they're wild leeks, so...
Yeah.
So nice, mild flavor in all kinds of different ways that you'd use leeks. So
exactly.
Enjoy them, Jerry. They're good stuff. They're good stuff. Okay. So one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about that we haven't gotten a chance to yet is pots, you know, we're all going to be probably
containers.
Yes, we're going to be doing those now soon if we haven't already. What tips do you have for that? Because sometimes they look great, sometimes they don't. So,
Yeah, and I'm going to put a plug in again for the library program because
Good.
We did containers for sun and shade, because that's probably the biggest challenge to start with when you're designing them. And then keeping them looking good, as you mentioned, is the next challenge. So that webinar is still available, and the handout is very detailed. So if you see a container combination you like, the handout describes it. So I go through just in the same order, because that's probably one of the biggest questions I get. Ooh, I like that. What are those plants? So, right, make sure the plants tolerate the growing conditions, sun, shade, that they all require the same amount of moisture for ease of care. Find a quality planting mix that works for you. And everybody's different. So, you know, finding one, I like one that uses some leaf compost, a little bit of peat moss. I use an organic one that uses rice hulls for drainage. That works for me. Some people prefer those with coir, C-O-I-R, which are the husk of coconuts. So finding the potting mix that works for you, but invest in a quality potting mix. Container with holes, drainage holes, because even if you could water perfectly, it's going to rain. And it may rain too much, and then the pots, you know, if there's no drainage holes, your plants will be floating. And then I use, and people who know me, I use Milorganite. It's a low nitrogen, slow release fertilizer, because again, low input gardener. So I fertilize right at, when I plant, and then I may not need to fertilize at all or midsummer, depending on how hot it is, how often I watered, you know, how many plants I squeezed into that pot. If you do a liquid feed, remember they're telling you the maximum amount, so don't do more. You could even do less. You can always add more later and follow the directions, or an organic, whatever fertilizer, check the label for directions. But you need to fertilize because you've got limited soil and lots of plants. And then grooming. Some plants need deadheading. Some need cutting back. If you cram your plants in at the start, you know, we want instant results, then you're either going to end up with a couple of big, robust plants covering the other more timid ones, or you need to do a little pruning. I usually, not always, start out with fewer plants, you know, maybe 4 or 5 in a 16 to 20 inch pot. So it's a little bare to start with, but it quickly fills in, and then they all still look good at the end of the season. The other thing is doing some seasonal plants. So maybe you want to do pansies, but, you know, when the heat comes, they don't look so good. Put them in a small pot, sink it in your big container. Then when they start fading, pull that out. You've got a spot to put a summer annual in. So it's less stressful for you, and you've got a place so you're not damaging the roots of the surrounding plants. Or do, you know, do spring, summer, and fall pots, you know, and just say, okay, this is going to be my spring show, this is my summer, and here it is for fall or winter.
I love that, keeping the pots in there. And I've never even thought about that, because I do. It's like, oh, I don't want to put pansies in because they're not going to, you know, they're not going to work. And yeah, that's a wonderful idea. I like that.
It makes it a little easier for you and the plant.
We all like that. Ellen in Eau Claire called but couldn't stay with us. And she is, her question was, what is the difference between compost and mulch? Because we've been talking about those, but they're not the same.
Thank you so much for asking. So compost is decomposed plant material. It can start as the garden trimmings or landscape trimmings, usually mixed with some soil or compost, a little fertilizer, so it breaks down and it's that crumbly material. And that's what we either top dress with. We'll throw a layer on or mix it into our soil or use it as a potting mix. And that is improves drainage on heavy soils, water holding ability on fast draining soils. Mulch, on the other hand, is something we put on the soil surface to suppress weeds and to conserve moisture, protect the soil. It's usually things like wood chips. It could be leaves. It could be evergreen needles. But they're not mixed into the soil. They decompose if they're organic over time, and eventually ground beetles and earthworms and things bring that organic matter into the soil once it breaks down. But that's something we put over the soil surface. And the finer the material, the thinner the layer. So an inch of grass clippings or leaves is usually sufficient. coarser material like wood chips, 2 to 3, but no more, because you don't want to impede the flow of water and then hold the soil moisture too much and then lead to root rot. So those are kind of the difference. Great question. I'm glad you asked. Rock is another form of mulch, but it doesn't improve the soil. So you can tell my bias. So sorry, folks who like rock mulch and weed barrier.
Yeah, I'm with you. I've seen way too much. What that soil looks like, if once you move the rocks and that plastic, you'll never do it again. It's just so sad looking. It's terrible.
It is. And most of us, it is. And I get it. You have to replace it. Some people don't like to look at the organic mulches. It fades. Lightly cultivate it and don't remove it. I saw a program on TV where they were like, well, remove your mulch and then put fresh mulch. And I'm screaming at them, no.
Why would you
want it
that?
To break down? I don't know. And so leave it to decompose. Don't keep piling it too high. Lightly cultivate. That freshens it up. And then when we talked about living mulches, right, planting a little closer together but appropriately is a great way. Then you don't even need as much mulch, and you won't see what's there. So that's another way to kind of get the best of both worlds.
For sure. So what are you excited about planting this year, trying out?
Well, I just want to mention it's the 30th anniversary of the Ways Petunia.
Is
so
it?
I got to include some. It is. It's hard to believe.
Wow.
I know. So there's lots of new ones there. I love Lysianthus, and I'm trying it again in a pot. It's related to our gentians, our native gentians. And I'm trying it again. I've got some new tomatoes. I grew Zenzi last year, which is a paste tomato, Zenzei, much bigger. Early Resilience is my favorite paste tomato, but this one's a little bigger, and I'm going to give it another try. I had one plant last year, and I think I'm going to give it another try this year. I'm trying to think of what plants I have in the back. One of the little girl series magnolia, not new, but it's going to be new to my yard. I'm trying to find the best spot because I'm pretty windy. I have a Betty. My mom's name was Betty, and I finally found Betty to add to my landscape.
And nice.
So I'm excited about that as well. Oh, I did buy some of the new columnar apple trees, fruit snacks. Is a new one out, Fruit Snacks. You need 2 different varieties of that for pollination, but it's supposed to have a really juicy, sweet fruit, 2 to 3 feet wide, 8 to 10 feet tall. I'm waiting for them to arrive.
That's
great.
Nice.
I know. Great in a pot, or if you're in a small space, use it as a screen. You know, you could plant them just a few feet apart and have fruit that you can easily access after a few years. So that's kind of the one I'm really excited about. Hopefully it's on its way. It's supposed to get here soon.
I love getting plants.
More time to weed. Me too. Me too. So lots of new ones to try. Also, Suntory has some new Bidens, Bidens, heat and drought tolerant, nice and dense, so much the B series. And so that's really good. And more Soiree, Soiree, Vincas, so double flower, small, the Kauai series. So we're going to have those at the Wisconsin State Fair for everyone to see, too.
Oh, wonderful. Well, they all sound pretty exciting. What's your next event, a live event?
So this weekend, I'll be at Ebert's Greenhouse Village, both Saturday from 11 to 1 and Sunday 1 to 3. And because everybody wants to buy their plants and get home and plant, I will be kind of walking by the checkout line and positioned to answer your garden questions so that I can help you.
Nice.
If you have questions on what you buy or need some help finding something to add to your garden. So,
all right. Well, I may stop by.
Beautiful space. Well, I hope so. Say hello if you do stop by.
I will. Well, thank you so much again, Melinda. We really appreciate you sharing your expertise with us. So enjoy your gardening season until we talk again.
Sounds great, Jill. Thanks so much.
You bet. Melinda is a nationally known gardening expert, TV and radio host. She's an author and a columnist, and she's written lots of gardening books. And remember, her website is Melinda Myers, MYERS.com. And coming up, we're going to talk about some vegetables and a little English. So stay with us. this is Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadell, and we're happy to have Beatmaster Irwin Goldman back with us. He is a professor and interim senior associate dean of the Department of Plant and Agro, I didn't even try to reread this, Agroecosystem Sciences at UW-Madison. His research focuses on vegetable breeding and genetics, especially beets. What questions do you have for him? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. So we have this teaser question, whether or not, Irwin, vegetable is a noun or a verb. Now, I have never heard of it as a verb until I read your paper. So where did this even come from?
Well, thanks so much for asking, Jill. I really appreciate that. And thanks for having me today. You know, so I think people historically have thought of vegetable as a noun. It's a thing, right? But in fact, vegetable is the product of a very sort of long-term public works project by humans to make a plant that we eat in a very immature stage. In fact, vegetables can't really be propagated as they are. So if you let's just take a carrot, for example. You plant a seed, you get a carrot. The carrot itself can be eaten as a vegetable, but you can't get seed from a carrot unless you store it for 12 weeks, vernalize it, plant it in the ground for the second season and get it to flower. So the vegetable is a kind of specialized crop that humans invented to be consumed immature. And in doing so, vegetabling becomes a verb.
I love it. You think it's going to catch on?
I hope it does. I think in many ways it honors our ancestors who came up with this technology that we've been doing for 10,000 years.
Yeah, that's really true. And, you know, I had never thought about it that way. But, you know, because we just go out and buy our seeds usually.
Of course.
There's a few of us really, you know, good gardeners that collect their seeds. But it does have to go past its eating stage in order for us to collect it.
That's exactly right. And, of course, everybody knows that the grains, so let's take corn or barley or oats or rice, these naturally do that. Mm-hmm. They go from seed to seed in a natural cycle. And the wild plants that are the forerunners of those crops are naturally going from dry seed to dry seed. Vegetables, on the other hand, are an intervention. And that intervention made more work for humans. It made humans do all sorts of divisions of labor in order to make it work, but it increased our nutritional diversity. And it increased our dietary diversity.
And now if we think about something like a tomato,
yes,
which is really a fruit and
correct,
not a vegetable, so that's a different way of looking at it.
A tomato's a great example. A tomato or a pepper, these things are botanically speaking fruits. And I think your question points out the fact that vegetable is a culinary term. It's not a biological term. So there are many so-called vegetables that are in our diet that are truly fruits or roots or leaves or stems or petioles. The tomato and the pepper are eaten in an immature stage, so we don't wait for them to get really soft and really moldy on the vine. Instead, we eat them when they're very tender. And in that way, we are honoring that vegetable tradition of eating it immature.
Okay, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And like strawberries and raspberries?
Yeah, in many ways, too, there are fruits that are that would follow this mold, although some of the fruits are grown on perennial plants, and so they would produce these fruits each year. The vegetables, many of them are annuals.
Mm-hmm.
And so the seed, the problem of producing seed on something that you consume very immature, becomes complicated. And I think that insight that humans had is really cool, and it requires a lot of thinking.
It does.
Yeah.
What made you think of this? I mean, are you sitting under a tree and getting a apple hitting your head or something?
Well, I've thought about it for many years, but there's a particular poem. There's a poem that I always loved, and it's by W.S. Merwin. It's a wonderful poem. It's called The Widow, but there's a stanza in the poem that I always thought about. I had it pasted on my wall, and I'm just going to read the line. It says, "How easily the ripe grain leaves the husk at the simple turning of the planet. There is no season that requires us." And I love that stanza. Basically, what it made me think of was, in nature, the grains, they go to seed and they go to dry seed naturally. And it will happen even if humans weren't around, right? Yes. That simple turning of the planet is enough to do it. And there's no season that requires us. But humans are absolutely essential for vegetables. And in many ways, it maybe because I'm a horticulturist, I thought, hey, this makes me feel, you know,
important,
worthwhile, right? So
right.
The fact that humans figured out something that required their heavy engagement, but they got great benefit from it, is kind of cool. And I wanted to highlight that as a way of saying, maybe it's like a pat on the back to the humans for figuring this out. And yeah.
Well, it's nice because a lot of times we get, you know, we blame ourselves for doing this and that to the planet, but we did some nice things too. So
we did some amazing things. And not to take away from some of our great accomplishments, but I think our crops in some ways are some of our greatest public works projects. Mm-hmm. They took hundreds of generations of humans and thousands of years to develop. And the vegetables represent a specialized niche in there. That is, I think, something to be proud of. It always makes me, I sometimes joke about it, but when you drive up to a part of the world where this particular vegetable plant was native, I feel like there should be a huge statue in the town square of a celery or a carrot.
I like that. I think that there's a future for that. So.
I hope so.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for opening our eyes a little bit, and we appreciate it when we're out there weeding the summer. So
that's right. The weeding makes it all worthwhile to know that we created these things.
That's right. And then when we eat them, that helps too.
I agree.
Well, I was very surprised when I picked up the New York Times not too long ago, and there was your beat. So
yeah.
Tell us about that.
It's been wonderful to see people embrace it. I think some of the listeners may be familiar with this idea that beets are a polarizing vegetable. I think, to put it mildly, some
yes.
people just dislike the earthiness of the beet. And when I would talk to people around the state of Wisconsin about beets, that's one of the most common comments I would get, is that beets taste like dirt and I really am not interested. We set out to create a beet that did not taste like dirt, and that is extremely mild. When you pull back, and we did this through conventional breeding over many years, it took about 16 years to develop. But when you do that, when you pull back the earthiness, you're left with just the sugar, the sweetness that's naturally in beet. And so you taste something that's kind of mild, sweet, crunchy, and it's the first beet that we know of that you can really eat without cooking at all. You can eat it just raw. And
that's
it's just
amazing.
Kind of, you know, maybe an analog for listeners would be something like jicama, or a crunchy, semi-sweet root vegetable. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what it looks like. And, you know, that has been really interesting for people. It kind of creates a new market class of the vegetable. In some ways, it did make us feel a little guilty, de-beating the beet, so to speak. You know, like sort of. But in many ways, it relates to the earlier thing we were talking about: is that vegetables are a work in progress. They're something humans developed, and so who knows what the next version of all these things are going to look like.
Right, because, I mean, carrots, weren't they purple to begin with?
Carrots were absolutely purple, and before they were purple, they were yellowish, and before that, they were white. So this is an ongoing project.
Mm-hmm. And I know that people are probably, well, what's the name of the darn beet?
So this one that I think you may have seen is called the Badger Flame
yes.
beet. But we've created a series of beets now that have, another one is called Spark. These are, they're red. They're named for their red and yellow pigmentation in the inside. So if you cut them open, they sort of look a little bit like they're
beautiful.
Yeah,
it's beautiful.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. But they're called, the culinary part or the flavor part is really that the mildness and the low levels of the compound that we call geosmin, which is the earthy flavorant that's present in the beet.
How did you find that earthy flavor? I mean, try to do it for those of us who aren't, you know, horticulturists and scientific and all that
yeah.
good stuff.
Yeah, well, you know, the credit really for this goes in large part to Nick Breitbach. Nick has worked with us for many years, and he's now retired, lives in Middleton. Nick, if you're listening, you know, I appreciate the work you did on this. I think Nick was, his idea and the idea that we had working on this was to do it simply by tasting. So we would taste... We would taste hundreds of beets as we were selecting, and we were looking for those that had very, very mild flavor and low astringency, so they were just, you could taste the sweetness. And so initially, we did it simply by tasting.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, we began using an instrument in the laboratory called a gas chromatograph that allows you to actually measure that earthy compound. So we could actually quantify it, and we could select based on the actual data.
So you could really fine-tune it then.
You could fine-tune it. And it turns out that geosmin, the earthy flavorant, is, by the way, geosmin is a compound produced by bacteria in the soil. So any gardener who's listening to this show, anybody who's listening to this show knows what that smell is like when you first turn over the soil in your garden. You smell that earthiness. That's geosmin, and it's being produced by microbes in the soil. Why a beet or a Swiss chard plant or a spinach plant produces geosmin is something we still don't understand. There is no good explanation yet for that. We have since been able to sort of custom design or custom breed these plants to have lower levels of some of these compounds so that, you know, maybe one of these days we'll figure out what the thing is doing there in the first place.
Very fun. I love that. Thank you for describing that for mm-hmm. us. Bill in Oregon, Wisconsin, emailed to ask, are badger red beets available anywhere locally? He would love to taste one.
So the badger beets are available from a couple different seed companies. You can go online and you can find a couple of different companies that are selling the seed. One of them is the High Mowing Seed Company. They're based in Vermont. Another one is the Row 7 Seed Company. And these are companies that have licensed that variety from the University of Wisconsin.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So locally, are we going to be able to find them in our grocery store?
So last season, they were in 300 grocery stores on the coasts.
Okay.
We didn't see them in the Midwest yet. They were in New York State. They were in California. And they were in Boston. We think this year, it would probably be this fall, mm-hmm. I mean, starting maybe
sure.
in August, we think they will start showing up in Midwestern stores as well.
Okay, maybe farmers markets?
Farmers markets, I would hope so, because any farmer or any gardener could have obtained seed of it and grown it here. So we hope we'll see
okay.
them.
Yeah. All right, excellent. Mm-hmm. We're talking with Erwin Goldman, a professor and interim senior associate dean of the Department of Plant and Agrosystem Sciences at the UW-Madison. What vegetable questions do you have? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@WPR.org. And this is Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nagel. Next week on Garden Talk, we're going to be talking to Mark Dwyer. He's going to be back to talk about perennials. And then we'll also talk to an author about her book on rhubarb. And we will learn about Japanese gardens. So all kinds of fun next Friday. Right now, we're having fun with Professor Erwin Goldman talking about his lab and his work at W. Madison. And we've got some calls coming in. But before we get there, what besides beets, do you work on
carrot and onion as well.
Okay.
And so we sort of specialize in the biennial root crops.
Biennial
That's our
root
thing.
Crops. I like that.
Yeah. And they're a challenge because to breed them, biennial takes two seasons to go from seed to seed. And so to breed them, you have to first grow the crop and
right.
then you have to store the crop, vernalize it, and then plant the crop in order to get it to produce seed. So they have, it's an acquired taste.
Sure. Literally.
Yes.
And how does that work with the students? How do they participate
yeah.
in what you do?
The students are absolutely essential. We could not do this work without them. They spend their time not only during the growing season, but during the winter season when we're growing the seed in the greenhouse, helping with every single aspect of this process. And I mean, any plant breeding program has built into it just an enormous amount of hands-on work. You thresh the seed, you clean the seed, you put it in a packet, you plant it in the ground, you thin the plants, you weed the plot, you measure the plants, you harvest them, you trim them, you store them, you plant them in greenhouse pots. Every single stage requires lots of hands. So we have about 10 people. We meet every single morning at 8 o'clock and start our work. And any given day, we are out around the farms of Wisconsin, or we're in the greenhouses, or we're here on campus doing this work. So
that it's amazing how many spots that this is happening and how many students are involved in this. And can people just like come and visit? Is that
absolutely
possible?
I mean, we would be so happy to have people visit. We're not really set up to be a, you know, to host visitors every day, but if people wanted to see what our nurseries look like and our plots look like, I would be so happy to show them. And I should say too that the University of Wisconsin-Madison, like many land-grant universities, is home to dozens of programs like mine who are breeding cereal grains, who are breeding melons, cucumbers, cranberries, potatoes. And this is one of the ways that we contribute to agriculture in the state of Wisconsin. And it is not only creating new varieties, but it is, as you said, Jill, training the students, educating the students who are going to go on and do this work.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's all part of the Wisconsin idea.
Absolutely.
Right? Yeah. Bo in Madison has a question. Go right ahead, Bo.
Hi. I was just actually listening to the thing you said about the agent that's both in the soil and the beets. I think you call it geosmin. What was the name again?
Yes, you're right. Geosmin is the name.
Geosmin. So I actually have a background in environmental geology, so I've studied evolutionary biology. Is it possible the beets are developing that as an adaptation so animals think it smells like the earth and then is less likely to eat it?
It's a very interesting question that you ask. Beets haven't been around for that long because they too are a creation of humans only within the last probably 3,000 years. So it's a little hard for me to imagine that enough evolution could have gone on in that period of time. But your hypothesis may have some merit to it. One of my favorite ideas for why they have geosmin is something that you'll be very familiar with, horizontal gene transfer from microbes, so that the microbial genome has introduced a number of genes into the plant genome. And for reasons unknown yet, I think maybe they could have introduced the genes for the production of this volatile. But again, I don't know the answer, and your hypothesis is super interesting as well.
Yes, definitely. Let's go to Jim in Ashland next. Go ahead, Jim.
Oh, hi. Thank you very much. You've got just the expert I need to ask about. I grow my own seed. I've done it for 20, 30 years. Hmm. What's happened is I've got a product that appears to me to be a cross between Swiss chard and beets.
Mm-hmm.
It tastes like jicama, like you said.
Mm-hmm.
Can they cross naturally? It seems to breed true. This will be the fourth year that I've planted the seed.
Mm-hmm.
The seed looks like a beet seed.
Absolutely. I have no doubt that you did, in fact, hybridize those. They cross freely. And there are even commercial varieties out there that are crosses between beet and chard. They're sold as they're sold for their foliage, and you can buy them. You can buy them in certain seed companies. So I think what you have is absolutely that hybrid.
Wow, how do you feel, Jim?
Thank you.
That's cool. That's terrific.
That is pretty exciting. Thanks for sharing that with us, Elizabeth in Platteville. You're next. Go right ahead.
I have a PhD in botany, and I also, my husband taught horticulture at Platteville at the university. And because of that, I learned about a lot of vegetables that are available. There are what are called rainbow carrots. They're available in some seed catalogs.
Yes.
So there are purple, yellow, orange, red, and white. And the red carrots are the most tasty of all the carrots.
Uh-huh.
Because my husband planted them and we ate them. The strawberries, the true fruits, are achenes, which look like seeds on the outside of the strawberry. So you eat the what is called the receptacle.
Right.
Okay, well, thanks, Elizabeth. That's really interesting. You know, we take all this stuff for granted, don't we? That's wonderful. Elaine in West Bend emailed to ask if the new badger beets have a similar amount of iron as the red beets do.
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that, but I don't have any reason to suspect it would be different. The only really thing they're different for, besides the color and the shape, is this earthiness.
Taste, yeah. Sure. Mm-hmm. Nikki in Milwaukee emailed to ask for recommendations for growing beets and other root vegetables in containers.
Yeah, it's tricky to grow in containers. I have found that certain root vegetables do well. Beets actually will do fairly well in a container. Carrots, not so much. Why that is, don't really know. So I think it does depend on what you want to grow. And the larger the volume, the deeper, the better. And also, of course, anytime you're doing container gardening, you have to think about moisture because it is very difficult to keep them wet enough. However, crops like carrot are sensitive to sitting in water. So it's really hard to dial the moisture in properly for a crop like carrot. I would go with something like radishes or beets if you can. I think or parsnips, maybe they will do a little bit better than carrot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you would have to have a lot of volume of soil, right?
Yes,
for that.
You would.
To do that. But do some experimenting, Nikki. That's half of the fun.
Mm-hmm.
So as far as your own garden, Erwin, do you garden at home?
You know, I feel like I get enough of it during the day at work these days.
That.
I mean, maybe someday I'll develop it. But we do have some ornament. My wife and I just recently planted a lot of ornamentals in our yard. So we do that. But not so much the edible plants.
Not so much the edible plants. Mm-hmm. Plants. So what are some of the experiments you're doing besides the beets?
So our lab is focused on developing disease-resistant vegetable varieties. That's a big thing for growers. And,
mm-hmm.
and of course, anything that we can do to contribute to disease resistance means the farmer or the gardener has to use less chemicals, less pesticides, and that sort of thing. So that's a project that we're working on. Another project that we're doing is we're trying to understand the genetic control of shape of root vegetables. So you may be familiar with this. In the case of the fruits, or even in peaches, we have flat peaches. We
no.
have flat tomatoes. We have little tiny round tomatoes. We have, you know, the fruits, there's huge variation in the shapes of the fruits.
Sure.
We are currently testing a hypothesis that the genes that cause those fruits to be different shapes are the same genes that also make the roots different shapes. And so there are many different shaped onions and beets and carrots. And so that's a big project in our lab, too, is trying to understand the genetic control of that.
And why would we want a different shape of these?
I think we eat with our eyes and uh-huh. we select vegetables with our eyes. And if you look at listeners who have seen the flat onions or listeners who have seen the little baby carrots that are little round carrots, sometimes I think they're very attractive to the consumer.
Yeah.
So we're interested in understanding that so that we can manipulate that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so then your work benefits, we were talking earlier about, you know, the whole state, but in particular, the farmers that produce these.
The
right?
farmers that would grow these, the gardeners that would grow them, the mm-hmm. seed companies that would sell the seed. And of course, I think the vegetables are just an important contribution to our dietary diversity, nutritional intake, and all of that. So it's a part of that whole system. And these vegetables would go not just for the fresh market, but also for canning. They would go for, you know, for those who preserve food. So in many ways, hopefully it's it's not a major part of the food system, but hopefully an important one.
And do you look for vegetables that are better at being eaten fresh or being canned or frozen?
Both. I have this badger beet that we talked about is more geared towards a fresh market product, but we also develop them beets and carrots that can be canned or that can be processed because that's a very important industry in the state of Wisconsin and in the Midwest. And it's a very important thing for us as a society to have food preserved like that.
Oh, absolutely.
So we do both.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And do the farmers then give you results of their...
Many times we get pictures from them, we get data from them, and we also get to visit their farms and see what it looks like. Because interestingly, a variety won't look the same in all parts of the state. In the central part of Wisconsin, in the sand, it will look different than it would in the mineral soils of the southeast. And so we do need to travel around and look at that.
Yeah, because that really does make sense. So what you grow down here might not necessarily relate. Okay.
Exactly.
Wonderful. Okay. Well, in the last couple, well, we don't have much longer to go, but in the last few seconds, what would you tell people about beets that they should remember?
Well, I think that it's don't be afraid of them, I guess is what I'd want to say. Even if you don't like the earthiness, even if you buy regular red beets that are earthy from the farmer's market or from the grocery store, you can roast them. I can oven roast them with other vegetables, and you'll lose some of that earthy flavor, and they are fantastic. So don't miss the opportunity, I guess is what I'd say.
That's a great way to end it. Thank you so much for being here with us today. And thanks to you for joining us at Garden Talk. This and all of our shows, of course, are a team effort, and they include Clara Neipert, Joel Patenaude, Lee Rayburn, Jeff Robbins, and, of course, Larry Mueller. I'm the executive producer, Jill Nadeau. Go out and enjoy your garden this weekend.